Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Google has removed about 46 mobile apps from its Play Store after a BuzzFeed News investigation revealed that the app developer was committing ad fraud. Prior to this removal of Dio Global, the Chinese app developer had about 100 apps on the Play Store with some 600 million installs. Joining us by phone is BuzzFeed News media editor who conducted the investigation, Craig Silverman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
What do we know about Dio Global besides the fact that it's Chinese?
Well, one of the really important factors about them is they were actually, until just about a year ago, a subsidiary of Baidu, which is one of the e-commerce and tech giants in China overall. So they have a link to a major, major Chinese tech company, and Baidu owns roughly about 34% of Dio Global still. So they are kind of linked to Chinese tech royalty in a certain way.
How did you figure this out? How did you know they were doing this?
Well, it started with me just kind of wondering about apps, Android apps that are in the Google Play Store where you can download the apps that were taking a lot more permissions than they need. So, you know, when you download an app, that app needs to access certain things on your phone in order to work. And, you know, let's say you download a call recorder app, obviously it needs to access your microphone. But there's been a problem in the Android ecosystem for quite some time of apps taking way more permissions, having access to way more things on your phone than they need. And so basically we went and, you know, looked at the top charting apps on a given day and found ones that had suspiciously high permissions. And that led me to, in one case, a selfie app that took about 50 permissions, which a selfie app doesn't need. And then through kind of following and tracking things back, it turned out that that app was owned by Dio Global. And from there, we were able to find tons more apps that also belonged to them and had some security experts look into it. And in addition to the permissions of use, we found that they were programmed to actually fraudulently click on ads when the user wasn't doing anything, in some cases not even using the app.
And what does that mean to click on ads?
Well, when you have an app open, if it's an app that makes money from advertising, you know, you may be using the app and see at the bottom of your screen or the top of your screen a little banner ad or maybe a video ad. There's lots of different kinds of ads that can run within apps on mobile phones. And so in this case, you know, you were using the app and you weren't touching the ads, you weren't clicking on them, but the program itself was actually coded to do that without your knowledge. And so it was registering a click on the ad, which, of course, earns money for the company that makes the app because the advertiser now thinks, oh, somebody clicked on my ad and looked at it. So money gets paid for that.
So the fraud is being perpetrated on the company that's paying for the ad.
That's right. When it comes to ad fraud, which is actually a massive criminal problem, you know, whether it's fraudulently clicking on ads or, you know, using bots or things like that, this is a multi-billion dollar fraud that's happening around the world. And in this case, it is the advertisers whose money is being stolen. But there's also a cost to the user. So if you are running an app that is fraudulently clicking on ads, that's probably going to drain your data because ads can take up extra data. Mm. And it may also drain your battery because the app is doing things in the background when you're not even using it, like clicking on ads. So users can actually experience kind of some downside to this in addition to brands and marketers being ripped off.
We are talking with Craig Silverman. He's a BuzzFeed News media editor who conducted an investigation into app ad fraud, advertising fraud, that led to Google's removal of 46 apps from the developer Dio Global. It's a Chinese outfit. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dio Global also was collecting data from users, right? But it sounds like they were doing it legally, but it was sketchy.
Yeah. So when an app developer gets its app into something like the Play Store or in Apple's case, the App Store, they have to put a privacy policy there. And it's true that a lot of people don't read the privacy policy of an app before they download it. That's one thing I would encourage people to really take a look at. And in this case, you know, the first thing is that Dio Global was not actually saying and telling users that, hey, this app you're downloading is from a major Chinese app developer. They were hiding their name in a lot of cases. The second thing is that the privacy policies themselves were not clear about which company was getting your data. And it was not clear about the fact that in many cases we saw data being transmitted back to servers in China. And so the user, even if they read the privacy policy, unless, you know, they started did the investigative work we did to figure out, wait, who really owns this app, they wouldn't know that their user data was being collected, that it was potentially going to be available, you know, to law enforcement and government agencies in China. And so in this case, it's not necessarily illegal, but it was really obscured, and that's against Google's policies in the Play Store, that a developer should not obscure who they are.
Thanks for your great journalism, but who's supposed to be policing this stuff?
Well, this is one of the tricky things about it is that, you know, the Android ecosystem is very open, and so you don't necessarily need to download an Android app from the Google Play Store. But in this case, we looked at that store because Google is supposed to be policing its own app store. When you submit an app to be, you know, available in the Google Play Store, Google is supposed to be reviewing it for things like malware and deeply malicious stuff. But Google also sets the rules because it's its store. Ad fraud is against the rules. Concealing the ownership materials against the rules. And Google is also trying to kind of clamp down on people taking too many permissions. So on one level, Google is responsible for this. And Google did not do a good job of making sure that this company was playing by the rules.
It's pulled the 46. There's a lot more apps from this company. But you also looked at 5,000 other apps. What did you find in general?
So in general, we found a lot of other apps where it was really unclear about who actually makes this app. And we came across other companies that ended up, you know, being Chinese companies, although you would never have known it when you looked at the app itself and at the company that was listed as part of the app itself. So one, we saw a lot more of that obscuring. Two, we saw a lot of apps that were taking more permissions than they really needed. And then three, when we had some experts evaluate the privacy policies, we found that they were really vague, that in many cases it was kind of a dragnet approach where they were kind of taking a lot of access and data that they didn't really need. And so it seems like a lot of developers have been able to abuse the Google Play Store to get apps in there that maybe shouldn't have been approved in the first place for the way that they were behaving. And they're really not giving a lot of good information to consumers. And, you know, Google says this is something we're looking at. They say they're changing, for example, the way that permissions are being taken so that you have to grant it specifically when a phone wants to do something. And Google says they're going to try and improve it. But, you know, clearly there's been some problems for a long time in the Play Store.
To the consumer out there, what are some red flags they should be looking for?
The first thing that I would say to a consumer is, you know, the reviews are there for a reason in the App Store, and you should read the reviews. And I would encourage you to look and see, are the, you know, 4 and 5 star really positive reviews, are they actually from, you know, accounts where, you know, there's a photo and they look real? Are they actually talking about the app in specific ways, or are they just things like, hey, great app, you know, the kinds of reviews that you could maybe purchase? Mm-hmm. And then look at the negative reviews. Are those very specific about problems? Because you should pay attention to that. The other thing is, in the Play Store in particular, when you look at an app's listing, there is a link there under the headline permissions where you can click and see what permissions that that particular app is taking. And you just want to ask yourself, you know, does this app need access to all of the things on my phone that it's going to be taking? And I think between, you know, looking closely at reviews, looking at the permissions taken, those are probably two good things that people should do before they choose to download an app.
Dave in Westerville, you're on the air with Craig Silverman of BuzzFeed News. Hi.
Hi. Hey, Craig, great work. I really appreciate it. My question is there a place that users can go that's already done this work and we don't have to worry about the apps that are being presented?
Hmm. That's kind of the idea of Google, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is the unfortunate scenario of it is that, you know, the Play Store itself is supposed to be a safe environment for you to evaluate and download things. And so Google does put some basic work in. You know, there are cases where, for example, malware is found, but Google does a lot of scanning on that. And so, unfortunately, I think, and this is true for a lot of stuff in our digital environment, the average person needs to take on a little more responsibility with this. You know, there is some basic vetting that is done by Google before an app gets in the Play Store, but you've still got to do some basic things like looking at the reviews and the permissions and that kind of thing to do your own level of evaluation. Unfortunately, there is no foolproof one place that you can go to. You still need to make a bit of effort.
Thanks, Dave, for that question. What What is Google doing going forward to protect users? Are they good? Have they made promises to be better at vetting, or what?
So one of the things that Google is pointing to is that the new version of the Android operating system, you know, which is the operating system in your phone that you know helps with all the basic functions, particularly on permissions, they're not enabling developers to just take huge amounts of permissions. They're actually requiring it in future versions of Android that, for example, if an app that you downloaded wants to suddenly use your microphone, you're going to have to give it permission and say, okay, something's going to pop up on your phone to allow it to do that. And that's what actually has been Apple's approach from day one. So one, they're doing some things at the kind of phone and operating system level to try and make it harder for someone to take tons of permissions they don't need. Google has said that they're hiring, you know, more people to help with evaluation in the Google Play Store. But I'll tell you, the other side of this is that Google recently put up a blog post that was directed at the developer community, the people who make the apps, mm-hmm. and it told them that it was actually going to, you know, institute a more, even more rigorous process before they ban a developer. So at the same time that consumers need more protection, apparently Google is dealing with complaints from developers that they feel they're being, you know, banned and kicked out when they shouldn't be. So Google is trying to, it seems, kind of play both sides of this.
And then also the issue of the origin of the app and where it comes from. You said a lot of them, they're hiding the fact that they're from China. Is China a notoriously bad actor on this score, and that should be a red flag, or what?
Well, I wouldn't say that any app from China is a red flag. I mean, you know, there are some good app developers from there. But I can also tell you that, like, absolutely in talking to experts and in my own work, not just this investigation, but one I did previously, two Chinese app developers, prominent ones, one of which is publicly traded in the United States, were engaged in a different type of ad fraud. And so we are seeing absolutely some companies that are coming from China that are doing a couple of things. So one is that they tend to be taking a fair amount of permissions and a fair amount of data. Mm-hmm. And I think that in general, a consumer should be concerned if your data is being collected and sent to servers in China. And the reason for that is you can have companies in China, but any company, the law in China simply states that if, you know, the government, if the Communist Party wants access to particular data or information from a company, the company must hand that over. There is no court proceeding or things like that to stop it from happening. And so if you are concerned about your personal data potentially being taken and abused, you know, having it go to China is not a good scenario. So that's one piece of the Chinese picture. But the second is, you know, multiple times I have found companies committing ad fraud that can hurt your battery, that can hurt your data plan. And obviously, it results in money being stolen. And it does seem to be a problem with some Chinese developers. It's not only Chinese developers. Mm-hmm. There are tons of people engaged in ad fraud. But it's a behavior that seems to be cropping up again and again and again when it comes to Chinese app developers.
Craig Silverman, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is a BuzzFeed News media editor who conducted an investigation into app advertising fraud that led to Google's removal of 46 apps from the developer DO Global. There's more Tech Tuesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. People turn to their phones to track their steps, keep up with their friends, and for some, keep their mental health in check. But a new study reveals that free apps for mental health and smoking cessation included are distributing user data and not properly disclosing that to its users. Joining us by phone is a co-author of the study and director of the Digital Psychiatry Division at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's a Harvard Medical School affiliated hospital, Dr. John Torres. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How prevalent are digital mental health apps anyway?
You know, that's a great question, and no one's actually counting how many apps there are for mental health because you've probably noticed apps come and go. New ones get released, old ones stop being supported, existing ones update and change. That said, we've tried to estimate how many apps for digital mental health exist, and we've kind of said, including the mindfulness, the meditation ones, the medication ones, depression ones, etc., maybe there's up to 10,000 of these. So there's a lot.
Well, you kind of answered my next question, was what constitutes a mental health app?
You know, again, a really good question, and there's no standard definition of what is a mental health app. I think classically, we may think of it like a symptom tracker, something that helps you keep track of your mood when you're feeling depressed or less depressed. But a lot of times people are using apps for mindfulness to kind of help them through tough moments. They may be using meditation apps. I've even had some folks that we work with actually using social media apps to kind of increase their connections to other people and kind of be more social. So there's really not a great definition for it.
How did you conduct the study?
So the study was conducted in partnership with something called the Black Dog Institute, which is at the University of New South Wales, rather far away from Boston in Sydney, Australia. And we worked with two researchers there, Kit Huckville, who led the study, and Mark Larson. And what happened in the study is, in essence, we read the privacy policies of popular mental health apps for depression and for smoking cessation. And reading those privacy policies is not the most exciting activity. They're a little bit legalese. They're a little bit boring. They're kind of complex, too. But we read the privacy policies, and then Kit Huckville conducted something that's similar to what we would call in technical terms a man-in-the-middle attack, in which basically he was able to intercept where the app was sending packets or traffic to. So the app, you may enter into your phone, I have a diagnosis of depression, and I take this medication. And basically, we are able to, again, intercept where the app was sending information to, almost what was the address where information was going to be headed to. And we said, does where the app actually sends information to, does that match what the privacy policy says, right? Mm-hmm. So is what you've been promised by the app actually what happens in reality?
I go into, you know, have a session with a psychiatrist. That is confidential information. Whatever, you know, something comes from a blood draw at the physician's office, that is confidential information. Those are from the HIPAA, the federal law that protects patient privacy. Don't those apply when it comes to these kinds of apps?
You know, that's a really good question of why isn't this information automatically private? And the reason is a lot of these apps, in those terms and conditions or privacy policy, again, in that mouse print, they have this line that says, actually, we may look like a medical app, but really we're just a health and wellness product. And because we're a health and wellness product, we're not subject to these federal regulations around healthcare privacy. So what they'll actually do, if you look at the privacy policy, they'll say, you know, we make no guarantees, we make no claims about this, and they'll be very careful if you actually look to say, they'll say, you know, we work on stress, sometimes not anxiety. They'll say we help with mood, not depression. They'll find that thin red line between wellness and mental health and sit just on the edge of wellness. And because of that, really what they do with your data is really determined by what the privacy policy says. In some ways, you don't have those federal protections that you may think and expect and perhaps should.
We are talking about privacy policies or the lack thereof when it comes to mental health apps, everything from meditation apps to things that specifically ask you about your mood, apps geared toward people who are depressed, apps geared toward people with all sorts of mental health and mental illness issues. If you use one of these apps and have a question about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is John Torres. He's director of the Digital Psychiatry Division at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's co-author of a study on the distribution of user data by free mental health and smoking cessation apps. So 29 of these transmitted data to services provided by Facebook or Google. What were these services?
Usually these services that the apps are sending data to are analytical services where the person who made the app or the company who made the app, they want to know a little bit about who's using the app. Where is that person coming from? Are they a repeat user? What are the demographics of the user? So in general, it was a lot of kind of analytical platforms. So in some ways, similar perhaps to what cookies are kind of doing.
Mm-hmm.
On the internet, but in some of them, I said it was hard to actually fully understand what they are. But a lot were going to Facebook Analytics, and a lot were going to Google Analytics.
Meaning, next thing I know, an ad for Zoloft pops up on Facebook?
You know, that's a really good question of what does it mean that kind of these little digital breadcrumbs are mm-hmm. being transmitted to other companies? And in part, what we weren't able to answer the study is what happens to your data at these services? Is it just run for reports that the app developer makes? Is it integrated with other types of information? Is it used? Can it be used to re-identify you if you have enough breadcrumbs all leading to the same place? What does it mean that this digital breadcrumb came from a mental health app? Does that alone kind of tell a lot about someone? It's a little bit hard to know, as you said, is it being used for advertising? Perhaps one of the chief concerns is I think we know in this increasingly digital era, it's possible to re-identify information or information that we think is non-re-identifiable today. I'm sure if we fast forward to year, let's say even 2021, mm-hmm. people are finding ways to put information back together and to kind of say where it came from and who it came from. So one thing I certainly talk to a patient now, and especially in the results of the study, is say, if you're using one of these mental health apps, that can be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Some of them can be very helpful and they can help people. But consider what you're putting into it. And if we don't really know who made the app and there's not a lot of trust in the app developer, maybe you want to look for a different one. Or would you be comfortable if in a couple years some list came out and said, here's people using this app and here's the information they told the app? Again, that's hypothetical.
Yeah.
But I think it's certainly worth considering or something, again, we tell patients that we work with here.
What are some red flags that app users should look out for?
You know, that's a great question. I think the number one red flag is a lot of apps, sometimes up to half of them, will not actually even have a privacy policy. If you just look on the iTunes or Android store, and if you don't see a privacy policy that's easy to find, that's a red flag to walk away from that app. And again, the privacy policy, as we've shown this day, doesn't guarantee your information is going to be kept secure. But my gosh, if there's no privacy policy, that's kind of your immediate red flag to say, wow, this app developer hasn't even kind of taken the step to even tell me what they claim to be doing with my data, let alone what they do with it. So by looking for lack of a privacy policy can help you within 2 seconds, I would say, screen out some of the red flag, certainly dangerous, concerning apps. Another thing that you can do to screen apps, and again, it's not going to guarantee you find a good one, is look when it was last updated. There's this funny term called zombie apps. These aren't games or zombie games, but really it's apps that have been abandoned by the app developer. They're not currently supported. And apps that haven't been updated in, say, over 6 months, something, it means it's not actively being supported, which means the information on it, certainly medical information, medical knowledge increases, updates, but it just tells you maybe there could be security vulnerabilities, the app hasn't been updated. It's just something is kind of not going to be ideal. Again, sometimes it will be for apps that have been updated, but it's a kind of quick test. You could say, is there a privacy policy and was it updated recently? And again, these are screening questions which may help you avoid some concerning apps, but there are certainly going to be some bad players that have been updated recently and have a privacy policy that they just don't listen to or adhere to.
What would the role of Google and Apple be when it comes to them vetting these apps?
It's a really good question of, how do you figure out in this complex evolving landscape of digital health and digital mental health, what's a good app and what's a bad app? And there's no easy answer because we actually don't yet really have a gold standard for what is a great mental health app. We don't have something to compare and say, this is what the gold standard will be. This is how we want to say this app measures up or this app falls below. In part, that's because the research on how these apps work, who they work for, how long we should use them, what dose you should use them, is really still growing. And I would say almost every couple weeks, there's some very impressive studies coming out talking about digital mental health apps.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of in this exciting research and discovery phase. And a lot of times it takes a little bit of, it doesn't take the decade that we often hear cited for a drug discovery to kind of reach the market. I think what's exciting at apps, certainly things we learn and research studies can quickly be translated into things that people can use here, now, and today. But certainly, I think the latest kind of breakthroughs in understanding how apps work, it takes a little bit of time for those to trickle down to the app store. One thing that we've increasingly learned is a lot of apps seem to do well with some degree of human support. And the analogy I like to do is if you said, John, you live in Boston, the Boston Marathon happened just 2 weeks ago. If you said, here's some running shoes, you now have the tool you need to run the marathon, I'm probably not going to make it through the marathon. Having the app or having the shoes is necessary, but not sufficient. And I think we're beginning to see these apps are very, they can be very important tools to augment, to extend care, but kind of using them to replace or substitute care doesn't seem to be where the evidence is pointing us here, now, and today.
Is there, for instance, if I had an app that was put out by Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, is that more likely to be safer? I mean, knowing that it's coming from an institution versus an app developer in China?
I would certainly say, having listened to the prior segment, I think one of the apps, I frequently recommend people look at apps made by the U.S. Veterans Administration, by the VA. The VA actually has a pretty impressive library of apps, including some for mental health. And they're good apps because the VA studies them. The privacy policy is pretty simple. It says we don't take information off your device. It says we do take some off for anonymous analytics sometimes. But it's nice that they're completely free, they're accessible. I know that the VA is updating several of them right now. But I think knowing it comes from a trusted source, like a hospital, like an organization like the VA, I think really does help in this age where you're trying to say, where does trust come from? And of course, it's no guarantee. Organizations, big and small, can mess up, can get confused, can make mistakes. But I think certainly looking at where the app is coming from, who's endorsing it in terms of who's putting your name behind it, the VA is putting your name behind it, it certainly helps. So I think I would add that to the screening questions we talked about of, is there a privacy policy? Where is the app coming from? Who's behind it? And has it been updated those three questions may help you kind of avoid the pretty risky apps.
Are there enough mental health-related apps coming from reputable institutions? Do most of the apps seem to be coming from who knows where?
You know, it's a lot of the apps are coming from who knows where. I think increasingly we're seeing institutions beginning to work and build mental health apps. I can certainly say I know we're building one at Beth Israel. It's open source and free, so we don't have any commercial interest in it. So I think we're beginning to see hospitals and healthcare organizations building apps, but I think the majority are actually coming from either small businesses, motivated individuals, people who we don't yet know as well. And I think it's exciting to see new stakeholders jumping into this space, new people bringing new ideas and perspectives. And I wonder, in part because we have so many kind of new players in this exciting app space, sometimes they may not even actually fully understand what's necessary to keep app data private, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, again, we have different stakeholders jumping in. They may think it's acceptable to kind of share data in this way, where from a clinical perspective, from a patient perspective, we may value privacy more. So I wonder if we're having, in part, in these early days, a little bit of clash of just different backgrounds and perspectives that with time will kind of become sorted out.
Are you envisioning a time where apps like this for mental health will be regulated?
I think we're beginning to realize that some type of regulation is going to be necessary. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is actually working on something called the pre-certification program, or pre-cert for short, where they're rethinking how they would regulate what they've termed software as a medical device, which would include apps. And it's a complex proposal, but the essence of this FDA kind of pilot that you're considering pre-cert is they're saying, you know, there's so many apps, and they're all updating constantly. It's very hard to keep up with them. Maybe we need to shift the regulatory burden one step backwards to the people making the apps and not what they produce. So in essence, my hospital, say Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, or Company X, would get certified as, let's say, an app developer of excellence. And because we've been certified as a developer of these digital health tools, we would have a more streamlined review. And then the FDA would use real-world data to make sure that the apps and software we're releasing is safe. Again, it's only in the pilot stages, but I think the FDA is putting good effort and resources to understand that this may be a solution, because I think almost everyone has realized that the analogy of this kind of being the Wild West of healthcare is certainly true, and that there's a need for a little bit more law and order.
John Torres, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's Dr. John Torres. He's director of the Digital Psychiatry Division at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's a Harvard Medical School-affiliated hospital. And more Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple removed parental control apps from its App Store. The tech giant claims this removal was to protect user data, but some of these app developers say they weren't communicated with prior to the removal. Joining us is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's App Day on Tech Tuesday. Tell us about these apps that Apple removed from the App Store.
So this is not kind of a new concept. There's been a push, both on iPhone and Android for a couple of years now on tools that fight phone addiction. And the concept here is to give you some idea of how long you're using your phone, because it turns out that a lot of people have no real concept of how often they're using their phone. And some of these apps have been really eye-awakening. Like it says you've unlocked your phone 274 times today, and that number it almost always takes the person aback immediately. They're like, wow, I had no idea that I was using my phone that much across the day. And so, you know, even before Apple and Google decided to launch their own initiatives into this space to kind of help, you know, show this information to people, there have been apps in these stores to deal with this. And Apple, over the last week, has actually removed a number of them from the App Store. And the general accusation from some of these app developers is that Apple did it to eliminate competition.
Mm-hmm. Well, did it?
It doesn't actually seem like that's the case, but there definitely appears to be some miscommunication going on here. Apple's stance is that some of these applications were taking too much data and not, you know, storing it in an appropriate way or weren't requesting, you know, permission to have access to certain data, weren't telling the user about certain kinds of data being accessed. Some of this being, you know, how long you are spending in certain apps, which means that the apps have to know that you're using apps other than itself, mm-hmm. which is not a big thing that Apple's a fan of. Apple doesn't usually allow other apps to talk to one another in that kind of way. So, you know, giving this kind of permission is something that doesn't really work super well on iPhones anyway. But, you know, Apple claims to have, you know, made this decision in order to protect, you know, user data, in particular child data, mm-hmm. For when kids are using iPads and things like that, so that information isn't just kind of gobbled up and sold. But the people on the other side of this conversation say that Apple didn't give them any warning. They just kind of went in and turned stuff off. And so there wasn't a time frame to make requested changes.
So it sounds like, and on one hand, Apple's just doing its job, which is what we go to Apple for, or what Google Play should be doing with its apps. On the other hand, if Apple's releasing its own screen time monitor, wouldn't they have to be doing exactly what the other apps are doing, which is having them talk to each other?
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
The Apple monitoring system has access to way more information than any of these apps could ever have because it's a system level feature.
Right.
So it has access to a ton of these things. Now, Apple has at length discussed its own privacy policies and how it, you know, keeps data on the device and doesn't ever pull it off the device to you know, view for itself. And how it deletes that information after a certain amount of time. Apple has extremely public policies for this. But yes, in order to do this, the software that Apple made has to have access to a tremendous amount of your personal data in order for its own tools to work.
How is Apple responding to this? I mean, it ticks off developers. They may go elsewhere, might they, or what?
Unfortunately, going elsewhere isn't really an option.
Because Apple's Apple, right.
If you want to reach people who are on iPhones, mm-hmm. and in particular kids who are on iPads, because mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to phones, there are certainly some other choices. But when it comes to tablets, there really just isn't a whole lot competing with the iPad, especially for kids. So, yeah, I mean, going elsewhere isn't a huge option for a lot of these companies.
So is Apple putting out instructions to them going forward that delineates what's works and what doesn't?
Apple has a set of guidelines that are included with all, you know, kind of developer agreements, and it publishes updates to those developer agreements on a fairly regular basis in order to prepare for new changes to the software, or, you know, if someone is, you know, trying out an untested version of an app or something like that, there's usually some guidelines that follow that.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the developers in this situation, Apple had not yet published an update that you know, specifically addressed the concerns that were present here.
Well, moving on from apps for the day, and speaking of tablets, Samsung is releasing a new tablet. What's the deal here?
It is huge.
Huge tablet.
It's an unwieldy thing. This is a 17.3-inch screen called the Galaxy View 2, and it is just a monstrously large tablet.
It doesn't sound like a tablet. It sounds like a laptop.
It sounds like a laptop or a small television. That's exactly right. And the small television thing, I think, may actually be kind of the point, because this is actually a tablet that's being sold specifically through AT&T. And a big feature that comes with this is actually AT&T's software preloaded on the tablet, which includes DirecTV Now and a few other tools that are kind of tied into AT&T streaming services. So I think the goal here really is to just have a portable TV screen that you know, streams specifically AT&T's stuff. That you can get if you're one of their customers.
Who's it being sold? Who are they shooting for here?
I think that this is, you know, people who live on mobile devices. You know, okay. This isn't someone who has who relies a whole lot on a laptop, but they want something portable, you know, that's bigger than their phone. When they're, you know, watching a video with someone, or if they are traveling a lot and they still want access to their DirecTV, you know, content and things like that, I think this is the goal that AT&T and Samsung together have here.
And it's the second Galaxy View. How does it? What distinguishes it from the first?
Yeah, the big one here is that it's slightly larger. It's slightly thinner. It has an impressive little kickstand thing in the back that actually allows you to prop it up in kind of a wedge, almost like a Microsoft Surface tablet, in the way that it works. And it's a little thinner, and the processor is better for you know, kind of better battery life.
And the screen, all 17.3 inches of it, how's it work? Looking, how's
Seems
it looking?
Seems to be a very nice screen from the testing that we've done so far. Samsung always has really nice screens in all of their stuff, but this is, it's really just impressive to like hold this thing in your hand and realize just how big this thing that we keep calling a tablet is.
Yeah. Do you think there's another word for it, or there should be?
I hope that there's not, because I don't like memorizing new words.
Well, you know how I feel about it. Oh, by the way, how much does it cost?
This is going to be a $740 tablet, which is $140 more than the original Galaxy View, and is sold through AT&T on a $37 per month on a 20-month installment plan if you don't feel like paying for it all up front.
Well, what if you're already getting DirecTV at home?
Yeah, so I mean, the point of DirecTV Now is it gives you access to all of those features everywhere. So if you travel a lot, then you'd have access to all of your DirecTV stuff that you've stored in DVR and things like that. Yeah. You'd have access to those things elsewhere.
Okay, all right. Now we're talking about a laptop. Razer Blade 15 laptop is coming out. What's different about this one?
So Razer is kind of an impressive company because it seems to be the only laptop company that doesn't really care how many times it releases a laptop in a year. This is actually the third version of the Razer Blade that we've seen in a year. And this version is mostly a hardware bump on the outside. It doesn't really look any different than the previous version. And these are designed to be, you know, kind of gaming focused laptops. So what you see when you look at this thing is this very matte black, just kind of flat slab. In the same way that a MacBook is very silver everywhere, these are just matte black, and then the keyboard has got a lot of rainbow colors and things to it to let you know that it's for gamers. But the display on this thing has always been really nice. The hardware inside of it has always been really nice. And this is kind of a push into what they're calling the advanced model with stuff that really feels like it belongs in a desktop. This is a lot of computing power inside of a very portable machine.
They're releasing, you said, an advanced and a base model. What are the differences?
So the base model is going to have what's called an RTX 2060 video card versus a 2070 video card, which is a complicated way of saying one will be able to do more with graphics than the other. But otherwise, they're going to be pretty similar.
They aren't cheap. They're both expensive. The base model is almost $2,000. The Blade 15 Advanced starts at almost $2,400. What do you think? Are they worth it?
It starts at $2,400 and it actually goes up to $3,300, which is just kind of insane. But the design here is for people who take themselves very seriously as PC gamers. Who don't want to be tethered to a desk. And so this is the amount of money that you would normally pay for a very, very nice desktop computer that you would play games on that would last you a while in just an extremely compact form factor. So that's kind of their goal there. So the people who are looking at this seriously as something they would spend money on, that price range is kind of what they're aiming at already.
What's its competition out there?
The biggest competition comes from a couple different companies. One is Lenovo with its Legion series. Dell has the Alienware series. These are traditional PC companies that also make kind of gaming versions of their computers. But the fascinating thing about Razer is that this is the only thing that they make. Razer does not make laptops for normal people. They only make equipment for people who consider themselves to be very serious gamers.
And that's a shot across the bow to anybody out there who thinks gaming's kind of a, you know, is coming on. Gaming is huge, though.
Absolutely.
And gamers take themselves very seriously. But what's the deal with the rainbow keys?
Yeah, so I mean, the keyboards allow you to set the keys in whatever color you want, and because they have the ability to set the colors whatever you want, they also include automated patterns that you can set that just kind of animate across all of these keys. And one of those animated patterns is a rainbow that just slowly shifts colors from, you know, to every color in the rainbow. And regardless of how you feel about gaming PCs, it's actually kind of pleasant to look at.
Yeah, it sounds really pretty. Are you paying for that, though?
It's included in the price of the laptop. You don't pay any extra for it.
Okay. Interesting. OnePlus is releasing a new phone. What is OnePlus?
So OnePlus is a company that we've talked about for a couple of years now, and a big focus for this company has been to deliver things that are deliver phones that are of the same quality, essentially, as a top-grade iPhone or a top-grade Samsung phone, but for usually $300 and sometimes even $400 cheaper than what Apple and Samsung are charging. And they have a couple of reasons for why they're able to make these phones as inexpensive as they are. But this year, they've actually decided that they would prefer to compete with Apple and Samsung where they are and release a phone that is actually, you know, on this kind of higher tier and kind of compete in this place where they originally didn't feel like they needed to. So we're seeing this thing called the OnePlus 7 Pro, which is going to be separate from kind of their you know, typical marketing of you know, kind of a less expensive phone. And the goal here is to just, you know, make the hardware kind of as crazy as possible for the people who care about, you know, the absolute best camera and the fastest processor and things like that in a phone.
It has a triple camera array on the back. What tell us what that's for and why you'd need it.
We've seen a couple of camera companies, phone companies that have done this with cameras in the last year. And sometimes this gets used where one camera is kind of a full color camera and one camera is black and white in order to offer, you know, kind of better dynamic range when taking pictures. This has the triple camera array allows for a significant optical zoom, a 3x optical zoom, which is greater than what you see with Samsung and Apple. And you know, we're still going to learn more about you know, what the other camera sensor is going to be, but it's more than likely a wide angle lens, which will allow you to just kind of take in more in a scene instead of having to switch over to a panorama mode.
Is it easy to use?
Historically, these have been very easy to use and very, very fast from phones. You know, the funny thing about OnePlus is that they really only kind of cater to nerds like me. Who you know, pay attention to phones that aren't sold in, you know, stores like Best Buy or you know, Walmart or the carrier stores. And so this, you know, this group of people, they're trying to get very excited about spending more money than what has typically been a feature of the phone has been a lower price tag.
And this one costs about $750.
That's what they're aiming at. We haven't gotten official pricing yet, but it wouldn't, you know, it would make sense that we see something much closer to $750, which again is a pretty significant price increase for what these phones have been in the past.
How does it compare to? Well, I guess what's its competition?
Historically, the competition had been, you know, Motorola and LG, but in this case, OnePlus is very insistent on being, you know, considered among Apple's, you know, latest phones and Samsung's latest phones. So this the competition here will be the Samsung Galaxy S10 and the iPhone XS.
And in that case, it's a lot cheaper.
In that case, yeah, that'll still be about $200 cheaper depending on which model you get.
Okay. All right. What's the best smartphone on the market right now?
Oh, that's a tough call. Right now, I guess it's probably the Samsung Galaxy S10.
Why?
Combination of battery features, usability. It's just, you know, the features that are available on it, the way that it can, you know, keep a battery for an entire day, and it just works very well. Has a lot of different options for many different kinds of users instead of making you use, you know, kind of everyone use the. It's usually a tie between the XS. From Apple and the S10. Now that we're just kind of trading letters and numbers.
Speaking of names,
yeah,
I don't know how you remember them all, but that's what we pay you the big bucks for, Russell Holly.
That's right,
Russell Holly. Thank you so much for joining us. As always, you're great.
Thank you for having me,
Russell Holly, Android Central contributing editor. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. It's been App Day on Tech Tuesday. Thanks for staying with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.